to any period of beautiful, calm weather. And those kingfishers? Even today, many species of kingfishers have halcyon or even ceyx in their scientific names, and they still throw themselves into the sea. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Camp KBOO is now in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44321 or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
It is Hard Knock Radio, Davey D, hanging out with you this afternoon. Joining us is somebody who is no stranger to our airwaves. She's the author of a book called Inflamed, a groundbreaking book that talks about medical condition of inflammatory, your organs being inflamed and how it's connected to social justice and issues. She is also a gifted musician. You may know her for her group, the Fishes. Her name is Rupa Meyer. And on top of that, she is a doctor, and a doctor who has been making a lot of headway because of her activist work, and most recently has made headlines because many of us have come to know her for her work at UCSF. She was recently fired, and fired because of her outspokenness around the issue of Palestine. So welcome to the show, and we were just saying off air, sorry to have you on for this type of reason, but as we're watching all sorts of things swirl, we should not forget that there is not only a genocide going on in Palestine, but there seems to be a coalescing of powers. You know, the Israeli power structure locking arms with the Trump administration, and folks trying to exchange notes, if you will, and trying to share tactics to suppress people. And one of the ways to do that is to criminalize, fire, and deem harmful anybody who speaks out against atrocities, whether they're foreign or here on the stateside. So kind of take us through what we need to know, Roopa. There's been a lot of headlines, as I said, but what can you tell us that's Thanks. Gone down?
Thank you, Davey D, for having me back. As you know, I'm 1,000 times committed to health for all. That is my life work, that is my passion, that is my practice, is doing what we need to do to make the world a place where children can thrive, where children can walk to school without being shot by the police or shot in the head, where elders can be cared for, where the water is clean enough to drink, where Indigenous people can be celebrated and secure in their sovereignty in their homelands, mm-hmm. Where Black, brown, white, all the colors of the rainbow people can thrive. And so when we have a health system willing to fire doctors and nurses, so I'm not the only person fired at UCSF, for standing up for the rights of Palestinians who are facing genocide right now, for silencing our speech, for repressing us in a racist manner, this is not an institution where health for all is being practiced, is envisioned, and that is a problem, especially in a pluralistic society like the San Francisco Bay Area. So UCSF is one of San Francisco Bay Area's largest health providers. It's very hard to go through living in this area without having to interact with them in some way. And the repression that I experienced or the firing, it's not the first time I've experienced harassment, intimidation, and retaliation at UCSF for speaking up for marginalized people. The first time was actually way back in 2011 when Charles Hill was shot on the BART platform, within minutes of the young rookie cop getting off the platform. So Charles Hill was someone I knew as a medical resident, and he was in mental crisis. And when he was in crisis, he was shot and killed. And so I penned an open letter to San Francisco saying like, hey, we deal with people in the hospital all the time who are in mental health crisis, who can seem very scary and intimidating. We have methods and practices to keep people safe, everybody safe in those experiences. No one needs to get harmed. Let us train you. Right. That letter went viral. And I got a call from the university lawyers that I was violating privacy laws. And I said, oh, interesting. Tell me how. Well, you're not allowed to say that you took care of this person. And I was like, okay. And you're not allowed to say that he had a mental illness. I'm like, well, I'm trying to describe his vulnerability. He was just shot and killed. And I said, well, technically, who's going to come after me for violating these laws? And he said, well, it would be his family. And do you think his family is going to get like sue me because I stood up and advocated for him not to get shot by police? And they said, well, I guess, yeah, no, they probably wouldn't do that. Right. And the family, in fact, ended up suing the BART police for killing a family member. So that was the first time I used my voice in this way, because I was alarmed at what was happening to our community members. It shocked me. And then as we saw Mario Woods, Luis Gongora Paz, we saw, you know, all of these killings one after the other, I started to really get interested in how our healthcare system could actually pretend to care for health for all when we were watching our community members shot in the streets by the police. UCSF is the second largest employer in San Francisco. It's not too many degrees of separation between me as a doctor and everyone in the community. Right. And so I really took that position very seriously in terms of protecting people's health. And so as I advocated for patients, people outside the hospital walls and even inside the hospital walls, advocating for Black patients who were not getting the standard of care, I would get harassed. I would get called into the office, called harmful, called aggressive, called unprofessional, all these words they would use to describe me when I very strongly advocated. Why is this patient not getting dialysis? Why is this person getting hospice instead? Why is this person not being referred for housing services? Why? I would just ask questions because I was starting to notice these patterns. And so that all escalated when I said stop bombing hospitals in November of 2023.
Over the past year, I've read many of your posts and your writings, and you talked about organizations that were pulling out all the stops, you know, Canary Mission, and, you know, there are a couple others I'll remember. I think there was like a Foundational Family or something like that, that were really starting to target folks in academia in particular, putting them on a list and then trying to undermine all their work. Were you victim to that sort of tactic?
You absolutely know, and this
you
was
talk a little bit about some of those organizations.
Yes, so this was outlined in what was called Project Esther, which is another project by the Heritage Foundation. So those are the folks who brought us the hellscape of Project 2025 that we're living through right now. They also made another project called Project Esther, which was a systematic destruction of the pro-Palestine movement by targeting and destroying the careers, not just like the academic careers, but the ability to participate in open society of academics who were speaking up for the rights of Palestinians. This is the tactic that got rid of Claudine Gay at Harvard. This is the tactic that's being used all over the country. And I'm on a list now, like a chat group of some of the best scholars in the United States who are all Black, brown, and female. That's right. And trans. And so, The trifecta of repression here in San Francisco is the Diller family, the Diller Foundation, which is the University of California's largest funder, a billionaire family. California Senator Scott Wiener, who is an AIPAC on the AIPAC payroll. He is very pro-Israel, and he has been trying to gut the ethnic studies, our ability to share our collective histories of struggle as marginalized people in our voices. So Scott Wiener personally targeted me repeatedly online, and whenever he
did he do this as a state senator?
Yes, as a state senator, he targeted me on Twitter.
In his capacity, I'm just trying to
through his state senator account
as a taxpayer.
Yep.
He went after you.
He went after
our tax dollars pays for him.
Yes, to target
somebody,
me.
Right.
Yep,
wow.
And harass me. And every time he did, the first big time he did, he would tag UCSF. He'd say, look, your doctor's anti-Semitic, which is just a malicious lie. There's not a bone in my body that wants to see our Jewish community suffer. And so the framing that he would use was toxic, and it would lead to months of death threats and rape threats, the most racist garbage I've ever seen coming into my inbox at UCSF through work, online, tagging me, hounding my social media accounts. So interestingly, the Dillers fund Scott Wiener's work because he is a YIMBY pro real estate developer guy, and they're real estate developers. The Dillers own the largest amount of, they're one of the largest corporate real estate residential landlords in the Bay, especially in San Francisco. So as such, they're able to control how the market moves. And their moves end up leading to thousands of Black, brown, and poor, or not poor, but working class people being put on the streets. And so the Dillers fund Scott Wiener. The Dillers money ends up at UCSF, and the Dillers money has also ended up funding the Canary Mission. So the Canary Mission is an online it's a website with ties to the Israeli government that puts up these profiles of people who speak out for the rights of Palestinians or speak critically of Israel. And they use those websites. This website has been provided to the Trump administration right now to be the deportation list for the students across the country who are being deported or having their visas revoked. And so this is basically a hit list. So since I've been placed on the Canary mission, my speaking gigs have been canceled. I've been slandered in the right-wing media. They all frame me as being a terrible person. You know, the worst thing you could think of someone like me who's been working to fight racism my entire career is now all of a sudden I woke up and started hating a bunch of people. That's completely false and fabricated. Right. What I stand against is genocide. What I stand against is land theft. What I stand against is the rape, torture, abduction, and killing of healthcare workers in Gaza. What I stand against is the obliteration of the Gaza's healthcare infrastructure by Israel, funded by our tax dollars. What I stand against is the silencing of doctors, because when doctors are silenced, Davey, people die. We need our voices to advocate for health for everybody. We need it unfettered. Whenever we see suffering, we need to be able to speak to the public and say, hey, this is what's going on. And the fact that it's medical institutions that are being cajoled by a state senator, Scott Wiener, and funded by a billionaire tells us that our, and on top of that, a public university system. So I never wanted to go work at Stanford. I didn't want to be a doctor who worked at a private academic institution. I am a product of the UC system, and I love being of service in a public institution. So the fact that that's been bought off by billionaires who are just choking our voices so we can't speak up for the rights of health for everybody, that is an alarm that should be sounding so loudly in everybody's heads. Because I can sit here and lecture about health equity till the cows come home. I can sit, write books about health equity. But what we're seeing right now is showing you why we don't have health equity. If we had institutions who were advancing health equity, they would be allowing us to speak up and they would be supporting the call to end the genocide in Gaza. And they're not. And that should tell people volumes about where the priorities are of our public institutions.
That's the voice of Rupa Myra, who is with us this afternoon. As you were talking, Rupa, I'm thinking some people listening may say, well, she's a doctor and there may be the equivalent to the shut up and dribble mantra, you know? You know, shut up and just, you know, and use your stethoscope. You know, you might get that. In other words, they would say, well, I don't need my doctor to be political. You know, I just want my doctor to save. But yet, we have praised a number of doctors who have been very visible. You know, one that comes to mind is Dr. Oz, you know, who's been a staunch supporter of Trump and his administration. Very politically active and outspoken. You know, nobody seems to have a problem with him, you know, as a doctor doing his thing. Dr. Phil, another person, very outspoken. I mean, you can like his personality or not, but he's still a legitimate doctor who's, you know, run things, very political, happens to be to the right. We have the surgeon that was running HUD for a little bit. I'm going to remember his name, Ben Carson, Dr. Ben Carson, right? You know, considered one of the best of the best when it came to, you know, heart surgery or neurology or whatever it was that he had, very complex medical thing. So I guess my question would be, were there other doctors that you're around that, you know, were pretty political in terms of, you know, you're speaking out against Gaza? I'm sure that were there doctors that were saying, I'm proud of the Israeli government and what they're doing. And, oh, you know, were they kind of pressured to tap it down and move in another direction? Or is it just you?
Yeah, no, it's there's doctors at UCSF who have shared posts on social media that say things like, or liked posts that have said, erase Palestinians from the map. That's a genocidal statement. There are doctors I've sat in meetings with who have said, we don't want a ceasefire, after I've explained how their doctors are performing amputations without anesthesia. After I explained that, you know, they're being forced to do operations by candlelight or by cell phone light. And so these statements are yes, yeah, so there is definitely a viewpoint discrimination. where people expressing support for Palestinians are being silenced and fired and suspended, and people who've said things that are now amount to endorsing genocide, justifying genocide, enabling genocide, these people are getting a free pass. They're walking, wow. they're employed. And interestingly, back in the times of COVID, when there was a Dr. Vinay Prasad at UCSF who was giving advice that was not based in, you know, sound medical evidence-based advice. And he was a UCSF faculty member, and a bunch of us on faculty were like, UCSF needs to make a statement that they don't stand with this person's assessments, like that the vaccines are not needed and that masking should be optional. And at a time,
right.
At a time when the virus was really affecting Black and Indigenous communities disproportionately, as it always has, and as it, you know, our mortality data shows. So for me, as someone who lives and loves amongst that community, that messaging was very dangerous and needed to be countered, so I could make sure that the people that I take care of knew how to be safe, how to manage it during this time. And so when we put pressure on UCSF administration to at least release a statement, their statement was, we support freedom of speech and academic freedom, and people have different opinions and they're all fine to express, and we're not going to take a stand. So very interesting how that happens. And I should also mention the doctor at UCSF who injected 2,600 Black and brown prisoners, people who are imprisoned in the California Medical Facility and at San Quentin. Dr. Howard Maybach tested industrial chemicals and pesticides on Black and brown people for years as a faculty member at UCSF without informed consent. Without informed consent, he is still on faculty now, I think at 90-something years old, $200,000 a year from the state of California. Even though this all came out post-George Floyd, he is still employed. Interestingly, when I was going to talk at the American Medical Association's first health equity grand rounds, UCSF called me to tell me that Howard Maybach's lawyer, whose name happens to be Alan Dershowitz, Israel's lawyer, he was writing a letter to UCSF and naming me and pressuring them to get me not to speak at the AMA's health equity grand rounds. So this pressure to silence me has been coming from these different entities for quite some time. This is not a new pattern. That was before October 7th. But now it's just off the charts. It's off the charts. And so what we have to think about and look at is how is our public institution, what are the relationships between UCSF and these various people with ties to Israel, whether it's the Dillers or Howard Maybach, Alan Dershowitz, what's he doing in the mix, right? These are all things that people deserve to know about, because our taxpayer money goes to the University of California. The University of California should be there to serve all people. University of California used to be free, like no tuition up until right. the 70s, right? So like, this is a gift of our labor as Californians. This is something that should be in the rights, in the hands of Californians to decide how we allocate resources. And it's not. And that's a big alarm for everybody. We are a minority-majority state. We got people, you go to any kindergarten through 12th grade public school right now, and they're all from all over the world. Right. So this is not a time. This is a time where we have to sit and think clearly, like, what kind of state do we want? How do we want to live together? And how do we create a health system where everyone gets good health care? So if we're looking at the statistics where Black moms die at 12 times the rate of white moms in the United States, that's not coming from just, oh, we don't have access to care. That's part of it. But once you get into care, I mean, even Serena Williams had like crazy stuff happen, right? Very deeply racist stuff. So how do we actually create it? We have to compost these structures, expose them, compost them, and build something better. And the only way we can do that is by challenging exactly the kind of racist repression that I have experienced.
Rupa, speaking out on Palestine, I mean, obviously there's a lot of people who speak out and have called for ceasefire and et cetera. Was there a line in the sand that they might say, well, she crossed? And I'm asking this like, you know, I hate to use the word compromise. Was there a compromise? Was it like, okay, Rupert, we understand, you know, just say that you want to cease fire and maybe don't say A, B, C, and D? Or was it the minute you said cease fire, lines were crossed? And, you know, the, you know, what, in that case, what would the solution be? Not to say anything about Palestine at all? Or I mean, were there layers and levels to what you could and couldn't say?
No. So the reason I am attacked is because my scholarship is around power. So more than any other determinant of health, race, socioeconomic status, gender, immigration status, yada, 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 what determines whether or not you're going to be healthy or sick in the United States is power. Who has power, who doesn't, how power is allocated. Mm-hmm. So that analysis leads to some conclusions. For example, okay, these people don't have power. They need power to be able to be healthy. We need to change how power is allocated so that those who have none can have some and therefore right. be healthy. They have the power to dictate whether or not a toxic polluting plant is in their neighborhood. They have the power to dictate, you know, how their schools are, you know, managed. Should there be police in there? Should there not be police? How do we handle it when kids do this or that? Like, people don't have power. And so they're subjected to these horrific dynamics that ultimately cause poor health, an overburdening of chronic inflammatory disease, which is the thesis of my book. So there's nothing that I could have said. They were looking for something that could have, you know, set them off. And so from the very beginning, when I started posting about settler colonialism and my area of expertise around understanding the dynamics of colonialism and health and the history of Palestine and these kinds of things, from the first moment I started sharing about that online, I was called on the weekend by the vice chancellor. I was getting these harassing emails from different people.
But just posting online?
Oh, it was all posting online. I was fired for posting online.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And so as someone who's been employed, I was employed part-time at UCSF, 65%. They wanted to own 100% of my speech. And so online, on my Twitter and Instagram, it's like I wrote a song they didn't like. And they were like, wow. Oh, you wrote that song. Sorry, you're fired. We didn't like that song. So this is a big red flag for people. They need to understand what's happening.
I know you mentioned some of the organizations, Canary Mission and Dilla Family and all that, but we've also seen an enhancement with this current administration, the Trump administration, and a couple of things have been going on. One, they want to kind of enshrine any sort of criticism of Israel and make it into law, both, you know, federally speaking and, you know, there's been grumblings about trying to do that right here, you know, on the state side. So you have that sort of thing. You also have a rise of anti-intellectualism, right? So you have people that are quick to say, well, I don't care if she's a doctor. It's fake news. You know, she's fake. She's not qualified. You have, you know, this dismissiveness of your years of work, not just you, but anybody, especially if they are of color, which is grounds to discredit, you know? So you have a pressuring that starts to call into account, you know, let's go from one university to the other. Well, why is she on staff? Why is that black doctor on staff? Why is this other one on staff? Are these people really qualified, you know? And they will look, as you said, for these excuses to call into question why they're there, and say, well, you know, if they're there under some sort of diversity and inclusion program, maybe we need to shut that down. And, you know, and if you don't, then we'll defund you. So is this also part of the equation, this sort of atmosphere that has
100%. So these things are both projects of the Heritage Foundation, so the right-wing Heritage Foundation. And I should say, as UCSF shut down the pro-Palestine camp the same week, they invited Heritage Foundation fellow Elon Carr, who is to come and lecture to us about bigotry on campus. which was wild for us to listen to. And yet anyone can go and find the transcript online. But that really just, yeah, it just shows like the viewpoint discrimination. But yes, this is all part of the same reactionary force to try to remake American society so that those who are female, people of color, people from different marginalized identities are literally removed from their positions of authority, from their positions of leadership, from their professorships, and silenced.
Wow.
So they can't get jobs. They can't. I mean, they put a 10-year letter of censure in my file, which
is
like they didn't just fire me.
What does that mean? A 10-year censure?
It means that it will be impossible to get an academic medical position for the next 10 years.
Really?
Absolutely. They don't want me teaching. They don't want me having a platform. They don't want me having a voice, and that's why it's critical for me to speak. And for me to actually have a louder voice, because we need doctors to be able to speak up. We need all healthcare workers to be able to speak up always for the health of all people, period.
Are there unions? Are there medical unions? Nurses unions?
Nurses unions, yes, not for doctors, unfortunately.
Okay. Have the nurses unions, have they taken a position on Palestine or anything like that? And has there been any reaction towards anybody who's a part of the union? You know, we know that teachers unions have taken stances.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of the union leadership is captured. And so they're not taking a stand. The rank and file are taking stands. And they're organizing. So, for example, UPDI is a union of trade professionals, and so they have been organizing for Palestine. So different rank and file members are trying to push their leadership, but the leadership is way behind the ball.
But let me ask you this as we kind of wrap things up. With everything that's going on, Is there any marching order you can give our listeners to move things in a different direction, help you out? Is there any way to maybe pressure UCSF to move in another direction? Or is there something that we should be asking our doctors when we go into for treatment? And then lastly, whatever happened to the medical student, you know, because that was the other thing. I remember you saying that there was an IDF student who worked with the IDF that was in the class, and that seemed to set off a firestorm, you know, because you were asking, I thought, legitimate questions like, hey, man, you know, you're a doctor, but were you just serving in the Israeli army? I mean, is that something, was that off limits? Was that a unfair thing or...
Yeah, so the question I asked, so several medical students were concerned about the presence of someone on campus who had just come from Israel. And, you know, right now that's a place of an act of genocide. And we're a health campus. And we care about the safety of all of our patients and all of our students and all of our faculty. And so if health campuses are open to people who are coming from places of genocide, we have an obligation to make sure that we know what their participation is. So that was like, you know, the bridge too far. But in the strangest twist in my case, on page 451 of their 462-page report that UCSF compiled against me to fire me, it was actually compiled by the Paul Weiss law firm who gave the Trump administration $40 million of free legal services. So
that's right. So he made some of these law firms kiss the ring,
exactly,
and in exchange. So this is the result of that, the free counseling.
Yeah, it might be
to come after you.
Well, Paul Weiss they were the ones who, were involved in this report. But on the report had several pages that were fully redacted. Like, I still haven't seen the evidence used against me because they were like black rectangle pages. I haven't seen the evidence.
Right.
And so on page 451, there was a statement that said there is no first year Israeli medical student. So I was framed as targeted and harassing someone who may not even exist. when I was actually asking questions of medical ethics that are real questions that we need to contend with for the safety of all of our people. So I would say, if you have a doctor right now, patients, go ask your doctor where they stand on this genocide in Gaza. Just ask it. Like, hey, I just need to know, like, where do you stand on this genocide in Gaza? And if people are not willing to say, that should be kind of concerning to you, because anytime children are being shot in the head anywhere on this earth, a doctor should be able to say, that is wrong. Children should never be shot in the head. This is deplorable. It must stop. And if they're not willing to say that, that's something that you should sit and reflect on, if that person is the right person for your care. For me personally, I want a doctor, you know, who would say that, whether they was Jewish kids being harmed, Muslim kids being harmed, Christian kids being harmed. I don't care what the identity is, what color they are. Children should not be harmed in that manner. People should not be harmed in that manner. Genocide is always wrong, and it is our obligation. It is our professional moral obligation as healthcare workers to always speak out against genocide. And so that's really, and we need the public to get involved, because this is their healthcare. This is their healthcare. And we know that racism kills in medicine. We know that. We have study after study. Racism in medicine kills, and genocide is the most like overt and an in-your-face expression of racism. So ask your doctor where they stand on the genocide in Gaza and see what they say. And if they're like, I'm totally against it, are you talking in public? Are you talking to your administration? What are you doing? Because we need the public's pressure. We are your doctors. We are your healthcare. We are there to serve you. That is our job. And if the vast majority of the American people think that this genocide should stop, we need doctors to, you know, get some courage and stand up and speak out.
Rupa, we appreciate you taking time out, and we will be in touch. You know, we'll stay abreast. You're always welcome back to speak to us. Let everybody know, if they want to get a hold of you, how they can do so.
Yes, find me on Instagram right now and until they shut me down. I also do long form writing on Substack, and then we have a GoFundMe for fundraising for this lawsuit. It'll cover our court fees for all the depositions and the filing fees as we fight to liberate our collective healthcare worker voice. Thank
all
you.
Right. And again, you said you're on Substack under what? What name? Mm-hmm. Spell it for everybody.
RUPA.MARYA.
There you have it. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
You just heard is somebody who is very familiar, a Bay Area icon, beloved around the world, went through his trials and tribulations, and seemed to be making a comeback in terms of his health and a renewed admiration for his work. We're talking about Sly Stone. He passed away the other day, 82 years old, and it comes on the heels of an incredible documentary that really shed a lot of light on his brilliance and his career. We'll probably have to do a longer form, and I know there will be a long form tribute to him, but we did want to acknowledge his passing, and we had to go to the one and only iconic figure here in his own right, the history of funk, Ricky Vincent, better known as the Uhuru Maggot, depending on what circles you're in. Ricky, Sly Stone, as I said, you could do a whole class on him. And when we talk about, you know, the origins of funk, you know, and I don't want to step on your toes. You can tell me if I'm wrong. You got three main people that often come up: James Brown, George Clinton, and Sly Stone. Every documentary on it always shows those three. And they really do deep dives into Sly and said this was a musician among musicians. His passing and his legacy, what should we be thinking about?
He brought in the modern, the modern funky sound of the soundtrack to funky black life, and but it was a new level of open, because James Brown put the music on the one, so James Brown sort of established the attitude of blackness necessary in the soundtrack to our lives, but then Sly filled in that coloring book with all kinds of colors. And Sly said he gave artists of every dimension, every tradition, gave them all permission to get down and funky with it. And we all followed suit. And it's all right there in the music. Davey, you're a crate digger. A lot of us learned about, you know, the music history just by exploring an artist and finding their earlier work and digging in, and then finding songs that were influenced by that artist, and you keep going back and you find some more, and this style, nobody really did anything before that person brought that through, and this and that. But when it gets to that real funky vibe, all roads lead back to Sly and the Family Stone, and what Sly did to make sense of all the wildness that was going on. Davey, you and I both kind of look at hip hop and funk and distill it into rhythm and attitude. And funk is rhythm and attitude. Hip hop, rhythm and attitude. Well, Sly Stone brought the attitude of surviving in this world. We would call it psychedelics in the hippie scene, but it was really surviving in all the chaos that people were going through at the end of the 60s, kind of like where it is, like chaos in LA this week. I mean, it's like you're living, and yet it's a war at home, a war in the world and a war at home. And yet you're living and loving life and getting through it. And that's what Sly's music told people. It's like, deal with all of it and still, take it higher. You can take it higher. You can do that personally. And we've had to deal with, you know, movements where they say you engage the way you engage, whether that's on the street, whether that's on the canvas, on the painting, on the art, on the walls, you know, online. There's different ways, and you can be different and still contribute to something greater than the sum of the parts. And those messages just sort of oozed out of Sly Stone's music, and it was so engaging. We didn't realize at the time that this is a whole new formula, a whole new thing, a whole new way of getting these universal messages that fit the contemporary times.
As I'm hearing you talk, Ricky Vincent, and I'm thinking, I started off by saying we have these three pillars. There's obviously a lot of other people who are tributaries to the funk, but you got James Brown, they say George Clinton, they say Sly Stone. And James Brown, you've often talked about him being a very disciplinary type of guy. I want my music on the one, I want everything tight, it's my vision, you better stay on my vision, you know, there ain't no room. And I remember hearing some of his band members say James was fining people and going after them if they stepped in another direction. To your point, Sly seemed to give people a lot more freedom, even though their band was super duper tight and seemed to have the same type of chops and discipline. But let me ask you this. The thing that stands out for me with him is that he seemed to be a direct reflection of the ethos and the culture of the Bay Area. He had women in the band. It was multicultural. they address political issues while also having fun. You know, there seemed to be a whole different vibe, as you said, with him. You described it as, you know, giving it life, but it also seems to be very quintessential Bay Area.
And that's part of why his story was late getting told. He just shows up. If Sly was, a teenage star in high school in Philadelphia or outside of Detroit, like Stevie Wonder was, you know, we'd know his whole story. All the things that Sly did to break the rules took place in, you know, a New York studio, we would know the whole arc of his work. But he just sort of, bam, shows up. And then folks are like, whoa, who is this? What is this? How did this happen? And so the regional thing is part of it. And then the Bay is part of it. The Western, the Great Migration was really an opportunity for a great transition out of being contained by Jim Crow, all the rules and laws and oppression that was going on. And so Sly brought all those music traditions with him to this moment, to this place here on the edge of the Western, you know, hemisphere, the edge of the frontier, the edge of the American frontier. And so we got all that past, and here's this present right now. And you are free in your mind if you want to be. And so let's just take this higher. And he spoke to all those themes while you were just dancing to the music, just cutting loose.
Let me ask you this, Ricky Vincent. We know him and we associate him with the Summer of Love. We know that he was a radio DJ, like both of us, on KSOL back in the days. And so when we say Sly Stone, we think of San Francisco. Does that obscure his roots in Vallejo? And, you know, do we have to kind of look, even though we're talking regionally, we think of the Bay Area, but do we have to focus in on the musical legacy coming out of that particular city?
That's a little bit of a sweet and sour element to this, but the Bay itself is so, cosmopolitan and heterogeneous. There's so many different ingredients that go into the life and culture and counterculture of Northern California. All of that plays a role, but it, because there was a center, because San Francisco was the center of the Summer of Love, and San Francisco was the center of the hate Ashbury and the Vietnam War resistance, and these protests that were both marches in the streets and ideological explorations, chemical, you know, higher consciousness explorations. A whole counterculture was emerging, and the national focus was on San Francisco. So if there was a protest march in Oakland, it would be covered locally. If there was a protest march in San Francisco, that would be covered nationally. And so what happened was, there was a lot of the development of the band took place all over the place, because Gregorico, the drummer, and Jerry Martini, the saxophone player, they were coming up in bands in San Francisco. The trumpet player Cynthia Robinson, she was in the marching band in high school in Sacramento. Okay, Larry Graham was playing bass and figuring out these ways of inventing new sounds on bass coming out of East Oakland. And so all of the Bay was, in a sense, being represented. And Sly's family, or his sister and his brother Freddie, they're from Vallejo. You look at that, that's covering a whole lot of Northern California just to make Sly the family stone. But it's possible, it's likely they would not have rocketed to national recognition had they not, you know, made noise where the folks that were in the San Francisco-based pop and rock industry, the Tom Donahue's, the David Kaepernick's, that, you know, were kind of in the hunt for the new sound anyway. That's where you would find them. Most of us know that creatively, you want the creative stuff, you go to the town. You look to the East Bay, you look to these places where folks are. That means Sly the Family Stone really is a reflection of how so much was happening in the Bay.
Real talk. You know, he had so many songs. What song stood out for you? If you had to say, here's two or three, you know, songs that really capture the essence of Sly Stone and his brilliance, what would that be for you?
There are so many, but most of the time when you find an artist that's great, you can go to a B-side, to a hidden away track, 7 out of 8 songs, and the songs with the most of a message are tucked away down in the, you know, in the back of the B-side of album tracks and stuff. But Sly Stone was sneaking messages in his number one hits. All of us are familiar with Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself, and the bass line in there that Larry Graham, you know, put somebody turned the knob up so that bass line was so strong. Even if you didn't know the tune, you could say, hey, how about this song that goes don't don't boom, boom, boom. It's like a song that you know from the bass line. And so all of that is there, but if you sat back and listened to the lyrics, the first line of that song is looking at the devil, grinning at his gun. It's a song about standing up to the power structure. But you got to sit down with it more than once, because you're too busy dancing and getting funky to it at first. But it's a whole thing about, yeah, let me be myself, but it's also, you let me be myself because, you know, I'm not afraid of you. There's some powerful messaging in that
I forgot that was the first word of that song. Ryan should have put that song in the in Sinners, not to give it away.
He could have done that. That's exactly right. And those lyrics pop up again because they redid the song, and it's Thank You for Talking to Me, Africa, right? And it's a slow grinding. You think I'm looking at the devil, grinning at it. Wow, they went deeper with it. That's on the There's a Riot Going On album. So, so that's the thing. Even he knew that it was time to kind of dig deeper into that. Into that thing,
I think, you know, what comes to mind is Everyday People and Thank You Whitey. Don't call me Whitey, don't call me the N-word. Those were pretty powerful songs, and I mean, he did those mainstream, at least on TV shows.
He definitely did. And there is lore that, you know, the Sly and the Family Stone band, their first album was 1967. There's next to nothing well known from that first album. It's called A Whole New Thing. Creatively, or if you're a fan of Sly's, and once you go through Stand and Fresh and There's a Riot Going On and Life, and you want to explore his earlier stuff, you'll find just as much joy and magic and color and excitement and hope and funkiness, but and diversity. But there was no hits off that first album. And somebody told them, Sly, you better put a hit down, or this whole operation will run its course too fast. And so he sat down and said, I'll make something that will make them dance to the music. And there's the song, Dance to the Music. And so he quickly applied the formulas that he had known, because he was producing other people in San Francisco to make hits. Bobby Freeman did a hit called Come On and Swim. That was a big hit for Bobby Freeman out of San Francisco. Another group, the Bo Brummels, and there are other artists that he, you know, really put a stamp on in the Bay, you know, in studio sessions, helping them, you know, produce and record. And that would all be well known again if he was from one of these cities where the pop and rock folklore is celebrated with a granular intensity. People get into, you know, who was where and what session and this and that, and that his story deserves that level of exploration, and it's sadly only now coming about.
You know, I know on Friday you would be doing a tribute, right, to Sly?
Yes.
Yeah, so Friday night.
Of course.
Night. Yes.
And that's when you just show up and bring his records, and the thing will happen by itself, because the vibe is is just so good, even though, you know, some of us are struggling to cope with it. I mean, his music is so positive. Sometimes you just want to run in that direction, but Sly had some heavier stuff in there. Can't Strain My Brain. You know, he was going through it, and most of the time, folks spent looking for Sly. There's actually two other documentaries that revolve around the theme of searching for Sly, because people kind of constantly wanted more. And every pop star has gone through that. Michael Jackson went through that. Prince went through that. We won't let them age, that kind of thing. And Sly had to deal with something that basically no other artist went through. Sly, during the famous Summer of Soul, you know, the Questlove documentary shows that Sly Stone was the most electric, element of that thing. And he played the Harlem Festival, and then his band, Sly and the Family Stone, was the only band to also play the Woodstock Festival, which is the greatest rock concert ever, happened that same summer. And no group had to deal with both worlds, both communities, both, you know, entities like that. And so that meant wherever Sly went, he was the superstar in Black America, and he was the superstar in white America, all at the same time. And so how do you relax from that? How do you recover? How do you self-medicate your way through that one? And that's why Sly lived in a Winnebago for a good amount of time, because he could just be where he wanted to be, and he could
Real
chill.
Talk. And, you know, we're getting ready to wrap up with Ricky Vincent. Friday night, you'll be doing the tribute to Sly Stone. And Ricky, I'm going to direct people to your show. Marvin Gaye does the song, does the album, What's Going On? And Sly Stone responds with a album set of Riot's Going On. And I was going to ask you to explain that sort of undercurrent, because it's an interesting position. But you know what? I'm going to tell people to check you out on Friday to get the answer to that question. All right?
So, yeah.
So I'm going to let them dig in. When Marvin Gaye goes, What's Going On? And Sly responds, There's a Riot Going On. Tune in Friday night to find out the answer, because Ricky will break that whole thing down, whether or not they had a rivalry, whether there was tension, what was going on with that. It's an interesting story, so I'm going to leave him with that. Ricky Vincent, History of Funk, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, David D.
All right, peace.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
This is Calvin Trillin, and when I'm in Portland, of course, my ears are glued to KBOO, because ever since Michelle Bachmann said that Hurricane Irene was God's warning to curb excessive government spending, I know that God can send wicked things toward people who do anything that he might disapprove of, and I know that there's a lot that he might disapprove of in Portland. So I want to know if the end is coming. I want to be able to get some warning, maybe get some laundry done, that sort of thing. So what I do is I listen to KBOO. Thank you.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
eventually then go insane.
You never know what you will find on your radio / interwebs during the show, but it will be something.
Then go insane. And eventually...
That's the Vinyl Pajama Party, alternating Tuesdays at 3 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
To meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed double-breasted form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and of course a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer Joe that you have to know is that he's very much against manual labor. Killer Joe.
You're tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Camp KBOO is now in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through